Committee, Subcommittee on Public Safety for Tuesday, February 22nd, 2005. We are continuing our discussion of Senate Bill 5525, which is the Public Defense Services Commission. And as you can see from your agenda, members, we are continuing with Mr. Ozan, Executive Director of the agency, and a discussion of a continuing discussion of the agency and its performance measures. Let the record also show that we're opening without a quorum. Good afternoon, Mr. Ozan.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Peter Ozan. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Defense Services Commission. And with me is Catherine Aylward, who's the Director of the Contract and Business Services Division, the division we've described and you're focusing mostly on. She manages the contracting with the many lawyers throughout the state who deliver services for us. Madam Chair, if I may, I had in mind, I mentioned yesterday how it seemed to me, as a lawyer who used to appear a lot before the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court, perhaps slightly more informal, you were equally gracious and equally probing. I think the, I was telling Catherine before the meeting began that the nightmare of every inexperienced new lawyer is to come with a script and then have the court ask all these questions and you never get to the script. The dream of an experienced lawyer, and I hope I did it to someone, is to have a group of people who ask questions and take you off the script, which shows that there's been homework and thought, and I very much appreciated that. I would like to take a bit of time to back up, and only because I think in answering some of your questions, I don't think I put things in proper perspective. I don't by any means intend to go through page by page the materials. I think we covered it and you got me to the bottom line. But there are a few comments I'd like to make. And then I have in mind, Madam Chair, that when Senator Devlin arrives, I know he had some questions about performance measures, and I'd like to put that a little bit of context, too. But again, I'm here and happy to answer questions. It really does make me happy that you are asking questions. I wanted to perhaps to show that on page 4, I started off, and I know the committee is well aware that the public defense function is integral to the public safety system, and I don't think that probably can be said too often. But I also know the committee is aware that public defenders aren't just a necessary evil to make the system work. And, of course, the most obvious function that public defense lawyers serve is an assurance that the innocent are not convicted and that people are properly convicted for the appropriate offense. That's sort of the fundamental function of the lawyers. But if you think about it systemically, that process of really determining what the appropriate punishment and crime for an offender is also works systemically, because that process of competition between the prosecutor and the defense attorney results in dispositions that allocate resources that you're spending. So the fight about who should be in prison and who should be on probation, who should be in drug treatment, to the extent it's a fight, it's often just a negotiation, is really an important process that defense attorneys are involved in. So I guess I would view the defense function properly as we really are the gatekeepers of corrections resources. By that I mean that about 95% of somewhere around 95-92% of the cases never reach trial. They become the subject of negotiations between the attorney, often with the involvement of the judge, or at least the approval of the court eventually. Of course, that's true on the civil side as well. And when I started out as a public defender in San Francisco area, I saw that the most effective lawyers weren't necessarily the ones that were trying the cases and winning, though we all held them up as our heroes. It was really those lawyers who were knowledgeable about the resources available for their clients and could talk to the district attorney and the judge about proper disposition. And I believe, in fact, that led me as a criminal law professor to focus on the law of sentencing, because I think traditionally lawyers didn't spend enough time focusing on that. I think today in Oregon, with sentencing guidelines and with a very nimble and engaged judiciary that lawyers really do focus on sentencing. So that's a very important function that I wanted to emphasize. We are gatekeepers in the criminal area of corrections resources. We assure sometimes with the assistance of paralegals, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, you asked some questions about, well, do you look internally to the law firms to see if cases are allocated properly among senior and junior lawyers? The answer is yes. We also look in the larger organizations to the use of non-lawyer paralegals to do matters like, for example, looking at sentencing dispositions for our clients. And in that process, again, we efficiently allocate resources, and I think we also put organizations out of business that aren't giving good drug treatment or good corrections resources, because together with the prosecutor we decide that these programs aren't working for our clients. So I think that's a very important function that we serve. Another, and I wanted to call your attention to one of the pages here that I'm sure you looked at, but page 6 of our materials has a breakdown of our caseload. And this even surprised me when I first took the job, is how large the proportion of juvenile representation is. Almost 29% of our caseload is juvenile. That's both dependency, abuse and neglect, and delinquency. And there I want to, because we often think of ourselves in the very effective organization, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I sometimes kid my friend and fellow and commissioner Potter, John Potter, that it should be really the Oregon Criminal Defense and Oregon Criminal and Juvenile Defense Association, because that's really a critical ingredient. And it's really a contribution that defense makes to, I think, really directly the health and safety of Oregonians, because if we don't do a good job in terms of justice and dependency and delinquency matters, I think we're getting off to the wrong foot in terms of preventing crime. So I think effective lawyering in the juvenile system is critical. And as a result, we've made that an initiative as part of our strategic plan to improve the delivery of public defense services in the juvenile area, with a lot of attention to additional training. There is a substantial amount of research that indicates when parents and children in dependency or in paternal termination of parental rights cases have lawyers, the placements of the children with the parents are much more effective and much more stable. So I think in the area of the juvenile representation, public defenders have a direct contribution to the health and safety of Oregonians. So I just wanted to make those comments in terms of kind of a little bit of perspective of what our colleagues in the field do. The second point that I wanted to be sure, and you, the members, Madam Chair, members of the committee probed me a great deal at the bottom line of, well, what options do you, the commissioners, have in the event of budget shortfalls? And I think we explored that, and hopefully we kind of sorted out the various budgets and how many there are, and I hope we've communicated that, and we'll certainly go with you in more detail in phase two over those materials. I did want to emphasize that similarly, when we said in our materials that we're not able to prioritize, I hope you didn't take that as insubordination. But again, it was simply an inability, and legally as well as institutionally, to really pick and choose among various kinds of rights to counsel. Personally, there's a case that causes me some lack of sleep from time to time, in which the head of a large public defense system in California, a county system, somebody like me, was held personally liable for the individual failings of an individual lawyer. And I don't think one of the things I mentioned in the materials is an ethical constraint about me picking and choosing which clients will get lawyers. And I don't think, as your representative, you want me to do that. Is really, I need to be in the position of advocating for lawyers for all clients who need lawyers. And again, the tough decision will have to be made, as I pointed out, ultimately by our elected officials, you all in the legislature. But certainly there was no intent to resist cooperating. And in the process of during phase two of thinking about options, including looking at certain offenses, possibly as candidates for reduction of classification or to reduce the caseload, the cost to everyone. We'll provide all the information and all of the thought we can to assist you in that regard. Thirdly, I wanted to talk a little about or follow up on the strategic plan. Madam Chair, you inquired, and I appreciated it, about the connection between our employee performance evaluations in our strategic plan. And I hope I communicated the fact that we take our strategic plan very seriously. It isn't just window dressing for the public or for you all. It really is our marching orders, and we make an effort to connect the performance evaluations of our employees with the strategic plan. How are they contributing to the mission of the agency? I did want to add in that regard, I think you may know, obviously we are an agency of the judicial branch. We cooperate whenever we can with the Department of Administrative Services, but we are not an executive branch agency. We benefit from their assistance. And what that means in particular is we are charting our own course, when I say we, the commission, in terms of our employee performance structure. We are not pursuing a simply seniority-based promotion process. We are integrating performance into promotion and salary structure. We're still working on it because we have very limited funds. But the idea is, and we've already done it, we don't promote people in our organization based on seniority alone. Seniority and loyalty and good performance certainly play a part, but performance will really cause people to jump over more senior people. We've done that already in our management promotion. So I wanted to emphasize that not only do we have a performance evaluation system that's tied to our strategic plan, when we say performance, we really do emphasize individual employee performance as a way to get ahead in our organization.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Director Roseanne, I want to get just a little more specific on that
please.
Performance. Do you have the flexibility to go outside of the merit-based system that's governing state employees?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, we believe we do. We believe by our statute, Chapter 151, we do have the authority to develop our own compensation system, and we've sought unofficial opinion in that regard. Now, that's only part of the question. The other is, how do we balance rewarding loyalty and, you know, all of our existing employees are doing a good job or we would ask them to leave. So right now, depending on the budget that you approve and the budget the legislature approves, how much funding will we have to work with to give loyal employees who did not get any increases last biennium what are the references step increases, but at the same time trying to reserve funding to give reward performance? And it's a dilemma, and I don't know how we're going to come out that way. Now, I can say that, again, back to promotions, we are promoting people, particularly in the management positions, who are less senior than some of their colleagues.
Follow up, just we did some preliminary, and I went a little deeper to understand the step system a little more closely, so I guess a comment, if you would. I commend the fact that you would look outside that in terms of promote those who perform at the highest level, and I would also say that working with that system could be somewhat of a handcuff as well. So
just a point. Chair, Representative Hanna, thank you. And we're certainly, it's a very difficult difficult challenge for people like Catherine. It's easy for me to chart the vision, but then you have to work individually with the employees to get it done. And all I can say is it's a challenge to do, and we're certainly moving in that direction.
Before you continue, Mr. Roseanne, let the record show that we now have a quorum. And have also been informed that Representative Hansen is ill and unable to be with us. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my fourth point, I don't want to filibuster. I know you have other agencies here, and I and I do have in mind Senator Devlin's concern, so I'll try to set. I did want to mention something about performance measures in general, just to give you my thoughts about it and any feedback from you about them. So we tried a lot to think about them. Madam Chair, on a personal note, we worked together some 10 years ago at the local Public Safety Coordinating Council in Multnomah County. For those of you who have read Price of Government, our colleagues there got quite a bit of favorable attention about how the county was managed, and one of your former colleagues, Representative Beverly Stein, has mentioned a number of times in the Price of Government. So I only mention that to say that and that was back in the days when Vice President Gore was charging federal government with performance measures, so there was a lot of thinking about it. So I've had a lot of, I wouldn't say, again, it's experience, not expertise, perhaps scar tissue around performance measures, and we thought a lot about it over time. I think I've come to an accommodation to the needs of the legislature and the needs to us as managers by looking at it at three levels. We all know about the problem of output versus outcome, but not just on my own experience, but in conferring with, I mentioned yesterday, the Kennedy School of Government, an expert at the UCLA Medical School who's both a lawyer and a doctor, and many others would say outputs are very valuable measuring devices for managers. Just to show you how the organization's going, how many widgets are you producing? You know, it's you want to know that for efficiency's sake, even though you also want to know what the profit bottom line is in the company. So these are important indicators and tripwires for managers, and we have in our array of performance measures some output-oriented performance measures that Catherine Elward can certainly describe more, that really are tripwires for performance within the agency that manages the contracts. We think that those performance measures are a proxy, if you will, a substitute for assuring that we're administering the contracting system effectively. So that's one level that you're all familiar with, outputs. But I think they really can be performance measures. Then I would say there's a second level of outcomes for agencies, agency outcomes. And I hope you will question me now and throughout our relationship about those and demand of us performance and outcomes. And our mission is cost-effective quality services. And I explained yesterday how performance measure 6, through what we think is a rigorous process of site evaluations of our major contractors, will get to an agency performance measure that will assure you that we are accomplishing our mission. At least now there's a third level, and this is the one that particularly I struggle with, and I think respectfully you probably are struggling with, and that is what I'll call functions of government performance measures. And I think this is what the Price of Government was really talking about. How are you, as the ultimate policy makers and really driving because of your control of the budget, how are you going to allocate scarce resources? And you know, the Price of Government we're in a declining macroeconomic climate for government. How are you all going to allocate scarce funds among government functions? And I don't think my performance measures, or our performance measures, when I say my, I mean the agency performance measures, can answer those questions for you, at least as I'm thinking about it. It really requires, I would submit, you to consider a collection of agencies as a function and to compare them to other collections of agencies, and certainly poke at, for example, public defense and say, are you holding up your end of this bargain in this function? But nonetheless, measure for the purposes of your allocation of funding that functional performance measure. When we were talking to your co-chairs of Ways and Means as agency heads several weeks ago, I thought the director of the Agriculture Department really raised this question very ably that I'm trying to communicate. She said, well, I have a responsibility to assure clean water. Are you going to hold me responsible for clean water in Oregon? Might have said it a little more diplomatically, but that was her point. And her point was, well, we'll do all we can at the Agriculture Department, but there are a lot of other players here that are either polluting or cleaning up water. And how, it seemed to me, I think what her question was calling for is gathering up those agencies that affect that value, clean water. And similarly with public safety, I would respectfully submit that at this third level, you really need to gather up those agencies that serve integral in that function and challenge them, ask them what it is they should be doing. Obviously, they should be reducing recidivism, addressing the crime rate. I'm looking at Senator Winters because she raised some good questions about confounding variables. You always have to consider what other factors beyond what your agencies are doing. But really look at them. And I would suggest maybe in the public safety area, and this is just a suggestion in my own thinking, maybe you have to break up something called the adjudicative function, which we're part of, namely everything from the police and the prosecution through the defense and the courts, and look at that function and say, what are they supposed to do? And then, are they collectively doing it? And what value in Oregon does that have compared to other things? Why I say that is certainly corrections is an integral part at one point, but it serves other sort of functions. It certainly would reduce recidivism, but it's not as if public defense has a direct interdependence in the way I'm thinking with corrections. In any event, that's kind of my effort to suggest to you that you really do need to hold us accountable for those agency performance measures, but I don't think we can answer those larger questions as one agency. You really have to force us to assemble ourselves and help you describe what it is we do and why we think what we do is as important as some other function. So I say that in the context of you have before you some output measures and you have some outcome measures that we think are very important for our agency, but we can't answer the larger price of government question that I think that book challenges you to answer.
We will be obviously very challenged, and the question that you raise, how are we going to allocate these scarce resources, is the bottom line. It's the how. What this committee will attempt to do is apply a set of principles through which we will look at our budget priorities, our budget choices. There is a work group which has been led by Senator Winters, Representative Hannah, Representative Hansen have participated on the work group. As we move into phase two and begin those discussions around prioritization, we will look at those principles, and hopefully they will serve as a guide in helping us to make these choices. For example, at least in the draft version of the principles, we're prioritizing protection of victims. And Senator Winters may want to say a little bit more at this point about where that process is. But again, I'm making the point that we will be looking at a set of principles.
Yes, and it just goes to show you that my thinking on it is overly simplistic, because I was aware very much of those principles, and I think they're fantastic. And how I would fit into what I'm struggling to sort of capture is you still have a lot of power to determine internal to a function how you're going to allocate and prioritize, in the sense of what I was saying to Senator Winter yesterday about the three-legged stool. One of the dilemmas or questions is, what emphasis are you going to have on straight-ahead, red-meat law enforcement, which is critical, prevention, which is the challenge is how deep and how an inch wide, an inch deep and a mile wide prevention. And treatment. Those are really three ingredients, and I think you can, within that function of government, really alter that balance.
Representative Hannah, I'd invite you to speak to this as well.
Certainly the principles are, as you say, is an overarching direction, but I would concur with you that there is the need to bring in other pieces or other activities to help us get to the principles. And you are correct. What's going to be interesting is how we take what we do here as the Public Safety Committee and recognizing that some of those pieces that you're talking about are in another subcommittee. But you are absolutely correct that you need to bring those entities together, particularly when you talk about things like how we're going to address the methamphetamine epidemic that's in Oregon. It's more than just talking public safety. It is talking about alcohol and drug. It's talking about the delivery systems. You know, how do we get those treatments done? So you're absolutely correct when you talk about that we, in looking at the outcomes, that the decision that's going to be made by this body will also include the performance piece, if you will, and what the public part of it is. I think that's what I hear you saying, and you're correct. You're absolutely correct. And I think the difficulty for all of us when you have finite resources, in some respect, is forcing us to do what we would not have done had we had the 90s, for example, where every agency did whatever. And now we're having to say coordination has to take place. We have to look at how resources can be better utilized. We have to look at targeting, for example, in order to address major problems and issues that are in the state of Oregon. And we also have to do something else. We have to listen to what the community is saying as to what those needs respectively are. So I can appreciate your comments because you're right on target.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Winters, thank you. But I say that my own thinking on this is pretty primitive. But to say something a little self-serving, because I am here to serve the men and women who work in the agency and a number of others, is that it seemed to me, as I think about this as a newcomer to the Ways and Means process, the way you all respectfully have organized yourselves, which is perfectly reasonable, poses a risk, I think, to the effectiveness of these government functions. If you choose, and I would guess it's going to be very difficult not to make public safety a very high priority, because that's certainly what the voters want, and one could argue in terms of theory of government, it's pretty high up there, making the public safe. But in the process of focusing, as you are, on public safety, there's a risk, I'll be brutally frank and call it eating your feed corn. You can look at each agency internal to the function, wind up saying the function's very important, and now I'm being self-serving. You can look at Indigent Defense and say, we'll whack you $5, $10, $15, $20, $30 million. And what happens, and I can say this with some assurance in the 30 years I've been in the system, you have said the system is very important, but you've essentially, or we have collectively as Oregonians, hobbled it, because you have allowed it not to perform effectively, whether it's Indigent Defense or the forensics lab or fewer prosecutors. You've got a kind of a operation with three legs when you really need a four-legged operation. So that's the that's kind of holding my breath for Oregon, that you all as legislators make a priority, but then fully fund, whether it's schools or public safety, but make it work. And this goes back to my right size. What's that right size for all those moving parts to work together?
I just feel compelled to say this in the truth-telling vein. I think a part of our responsibility as a Ways and Means subcommittee, public safety, most certainly is to do the work of balancing a budget, if you will. But I think it's also our responsibility to be truth tellers and to say to the public what has already been revealed to me through the administration of justice overviews and as we get into these agency presentations, that the administration of justice in the state of Oregon has been severely diminished because of the inadequacy of resources, the inadequacy of revenue. That's where we are. There are cracks and fault lines all over the place. And so, you know, as a part of doing that, you're kind of reflecting back to us, just trying to figure out how scarce
currently scarce resources are going to be allocated, we also have to do the other piece, which is truth-telling. I was going to turn to Representative Hanna, who looks like he wants to say something, and then Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to use an analogy, and I hope you'll understand how it applies. One of my two boys is an incredible artist, and with a pencil and a piece of paper, he can do amazing things, self-portraits, and I can't draw a stick figure, but you give him a piece of paper and a pencil and just lead, and he is incredibly talented. And there was a day when he said to me, "Dad, I really have to have this cool computer that can do all these graphics and neat stuff because I'm going to develop my art talent further, and the only way to do that is to have this really cool computer." And it's a good argument. I mean, he in fact was compelling enough to get that done, and it did improve what he could do, and he did it. So I think where we're at in this difficult budget decision time is, first, as a compliment, you all do an incredibly great service to the public now. And when we sit here, we have to decide, can you continue to do that service very, very well, and how much more of this can we help you with? And it's I tell people as they ask me about this process, a monumental question of, you know, do you want it just to be good, or do you want it to be exceptional? And do you give everybody the tools to do it at the exceptional level, or do you just give them the basic tools and what you get out of it? And in both scenarios, I think you can end up with a good process, but is it the best, and do we intend to be, you know, good at it, or the best? And it's somewhere, it's not like we won't do a good job, because I believe we will at whatever level that comes out at. It's what part of the best do you want to get to?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, yes, it is your challenge in all areas of government. I would analogize your son's request to a computer as to our request for special policy option packages that we took off the table. When you asked me what would I say for the 12% increase to your constituents, I would say, honestly, I recognize this is not the biennium to get the computer to help me draw. All I'm saying now in this biennium, Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, if you keep the work coming, and the work is essentially the cases that the public and the legislature chooses to prosecute to keep us all safe, and the juvenile cases, if you keep those cases coming, we have to be right-sized. I'm not talking about computers. I'm not talking about anything additional. I'm talking about the capacity to handle the caseload. And if the caseload continues to grow based on choices of the legislature, I would submit respectfully, we need to grow, or you will have a machinery that is not credible. It will break down because, as I think, Madam Chair, you were suggesting, public safety is all about threats and promises. We call it deterrence. But what we're really saying is we're threatening consequences, and we're promising rehabilitation. And if we don't deliver either of those, we lose credibility. And I believe over the 30 years, I've watched a lot of lost credibility in this state and other states. We're not unique in this. It's just simply that we overpromise and overthreat, and then we don't supply it. So pardon me for the lecture, Madam Chair, Representative Hanna. I was just saying that it's a very apt analogy, but I think it's going to, we're not asking for computers this time. Just give us the Crayolas and the paper.
Mm-hmm. Senator Devlin.
I think part of this dilemma is when you look at all these functions, whether they're in public safety, human services, or education, I think you have to look at them in their entirety and recognize all the ties that there are in between them. My good colleague to my left here, maybe even to my left on some political views, but brought up the issue of the connection to human services and drug and alcohol problems and mental health. We have 560,000 children in Oregon schools. About 220,000 of those are from low-income families. If our schools become less vital, if they become
less able to move people into society to provide that equality of opportunity that all of us value. I can see you having more problems in your juvenile justice system and your criminal justice system as you get a decaying public school system in the state. And if the Chief Justice, if he could nod his head, that I could, can I recall a conversation that we had? We were talking about investment in education, and he said that one of the areas where he thought that we should be making what investments we can, because it's the most crucial, is for early childhood education, because all the evidence is out there is that the sooner that you get to children, particularly children that might have issues, children that might not have every opportunity at home or in their community, the better off those children will be in the future. And we make a relatively minor, modest investment in that area. And in fact, the governor has cut one of those budgets by about
$11 million.
And dropped, I think, the percentage from about 63 to the
53
of eligible children that are covered. So, I mean, when you sit on this side of the dais, some of these choices don't become very nice choices to have to make.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I agree, and I probably, in many ways, as some of you know, worked with me, are very much a believer in prevention. But I think what the public, though I'm not in agreement with the demands on government and the lack of support they're willing to give through their taxes, so they expect more, I think, than we can give them. Maybe now, as I think this is the price of government is saying, maybe now is the time when we really have to, and you really have to focus on the biggest bang for the buck, unfortunately. And the thing about prevention, which I think in the long term is just exactly the way to go, when you start spreading dollars, you can spread them very wide and very thin and spend a lot of money and cover a lot of, you know, the term false positives, a lot of people who would do just fine without them. This sounds like I'm probably to the right of all of you, and I'm not, but I'm just saying the question is, public safety in its purest form is targeted at socially destructive behavior that we want stopped. And are we being asked by the public, I don't know, to focus on that at the cost of some of these other things that I favor? I think it's short-sighted, but is that what you're really being asked to do?
Follow up, and then Senator Winters.
Yeah, I agree with you in many ways, but I think one of those difficulties is one of the issues that you brought out earlier and other speakers have brought out, and I think, I can't remember if the Chief Justice did, but he may have brought it out also. I got an email during one of the many special sessions from a constituent that basically said, I'm sorry, Senator Winters, it basically said, fund education and police. And so I had to write them back and tell them, you know, what the human services programs are that would be potentially cut. And then I had to say, by police, did you mean fund local law enforcement, and did you mean fund labs, and did you mean fund the medical examiner, and did you mean fund district attorneys, and did you mean fund indigent defense? And did you mean fund the court system? And did you mean funding corrections? And did you mean funding probation and parole and other services? Now, obviously, the person wrote back and was not very pleasant in their reply. But, I mean, I was trying to explain that you can't, a public safety system is more than, I mean, a very vital portion of it is the law enforcement officer on the street, but it is only part of the system. And part of the problem that's been identified here by people testifying is the general, not the fact that there isn't a broad understanding of all the things that go into this system or go into many of the systems that we have at that provide essential services to Oregonians.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I suppose the other challenge for you is you don't have, you meaning the state legislature, which is the highest level policymakers in the state, you don't have control over a lot of the functions in this public safety system either. And I think, and I don't mean to pick on my colleagues in the police and the prosecutors, but they're, as you know, locally driven, locally elected, locally funded, and they're really creating the business. So it's a very big challenge to try to bring these parts together, these moving parts.
Final, Madam Chair, just a question. I can almost make that statement. In some cases, it's the way it should be, and this may be one of them. but we could almost make the same statement as legislators in human services and in education,
right,
also.
He likes to pick on me because I have been around a lot longer than most. But there is this connector, and part of it, when we disconnect the connector, whether you're talking about particularly human services and law enforcement, if you really begin to look at those systems, they're connected. We don't get into to issues like foster care and those unless a child has been removed for some other reason. So does that say that no longer foster care is important? For those of us who do believe in prevention, and I know that the Chief Justice he's and I both, because the impact on the system becomes far greater when you don't do some things over on that end. And the system will not be able to continue to support, for example, the runaway that we're seeing now with foster care, where you have the methamphetamine issue. I think in this county alone, we have 200 new kids that are going into foster care. It can't continue to support everything going into the prisons and what have you. That's just a basic fact when you look at cost drivers. So it seems to me that one of the that we have as policymakers have to make some decisions respecting of how do you make certain that you're taking care of this entry into the system as well as those that are in the system and change the spigot? Because certainly the spigot is growing faster than the dollars that we have. And I happen to be one who believes in early childhood education and fairly believe that if you're training parents to be parents, and I've said all of us don't come here with a roadmap. You know, it would be fortunate if we were living in the generations where you had mom and pop at home and that took care of the kids and what have you, but that's not the real world that we're living in these days. And so which means that we have to look at how we keep our communities together, how we make certain that children are safe. And the other big piece that we don't talk a lot about, Oregon has the highest unemployment rate in the country. If you don't have jobs, people are ending up in those other systems. So it is going to be a real huge challenge, and I really appreciate your comments of saying that we do have to bring these connectors together, and we're going to have to make some decisions based on some real priorities. And unfortunately, I think that there are going to be some things that we cannot done. But I also think that sometimes when we're in a position of where we have to make tough decisions, we also come to the table to find some real solutions and of some problems that maybe we wouldn't have in the past. And I know this less body has a habit sometimes of sitting down to try to work through some of these kinds of issues. Counties certainly have a stake in this. Cities certainly have a stake in this. And certainly all of our stakeholders. It's similar to what we did in 81 when we had our challenges, and maybe in some ways a little more gut-wrenching because we hadn't gone through 10 years of where we had dollars flowing freely. But I would never want to give up on prevention, and I would never want to give up on linking services in this state. This state, and I think I said it earlier when I commended both the when I commended Chief Justice, who I know has made some huge investments, both personally as well as a legislator and as the chief, to get to a place to where in Oregon that we're not putting all of our resources on the acute or reactionary end, because that costs us so much more, both in human capital as well as in dollars. And I just needed to put that on the record because we tend to always talk about eliminating prevention. Whenever there's this challenge before us, that's the first place that we look at. And so when we see those children later our juvenile justice system and in our other systems. So I just had to put that out there. And then maybe that's the message we need to get to the public. It's kind of like when you're in business, you invest now or you invest later. Or you, if I don't count all my ribs correctly and I don't put the right sauce on it at the time that I'm making my barbecue, my customers don't come back in the door and I don't get the revenue in order to do a good job in business. So that's some of the decision making that we need to do here.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Winter, I appreciate that. I happen to share your view. I don't know if you all do this because you're all collaborators, but occasionally my wife and I will have people over and I have a captive audience and I feed them dinner and I get to think about what would happen if I could be public safety czar for a day or something. Well, if I did, I would invest pretty much everything in relief nurseries. You talked about it. I would put all our money in the juvenile system. And
I didn't pay for that.
Well, I know because I worked a long time with Judge Ann Aiken and what a great advocate of that she is. And I think it is the place to work. But, you know, fortunately for Oregon, Roseanne isn't the czar for the day or even a minute, and democracy is a wonderful thing. And I think the public is not, for some reason, Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we have not communicated the delayed gratification that's necessary for the public to have patience to see prevention work. They want immediate reactions. They want solutions to, understandably, violent crime, and they want it now. And I think the price of government is, and what are we going to choose and pick and I about in terms of sorting out priorities, it's challenging you to hold it together. I respect and hope you can do it. As I say, if I were running things, that's where the money would go.
One of my requests to the quote relief nurses is that they change their name, because in the public's view it's kind of like respite care. That is far from what they do, as you know, because the court is very much involved, and these are high-risk families that will end up in our system someplace else. And so I'm glad you're a relief nursery person, and I did not pay him so that you guys know that I did not do that.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Winters, a colleague of mine that I worked with in the 80s, Michael Frankie, he was a director of corrections, and when we went out to the prison visiting facilities, he would always say, here are my future clients right here in this visiting facility, this cycle of parenting that leads to incarceration. So I couldn't agree more. But I do think that the public is demanding a lot out of the public safety system, and the challenge is yours.
Where would you like to go next? I know that there are details you want to be sure to get on to.
Well, I don't want to drone on. I do want to brag a little, if I may, Madam Chair, and I think you've seen it. Just if those of you on the committee haven't, we have a letter from the Secretary of State's audit that I want Secretary of State's audit division that I wanted to mention. When I say brag about it, it's really got nothing to do with me, but the men and women who work in our agency. About 6 or 8 months ago, the Secretary of State notified us that they were going to investigate preliminary to an audit. We pretty much believe that, and I'm referring now, if I hadn't already, to Appendix D, is what's the outcome of the preliminary investigation. And we said, we took it positively and said, well, we're a new agency, we'll learn through the audit what you have to offer, and we kind of expected that the investigation would lead to an audit. I don't know, am I cynical? But when someone looks, they want to find something, and we would probably have an audit. Well, after looking for several months, interviewing all of our employees, investigating the matter, the Secretary of State's division decided that an audit wasn't called for. In their terminology, there was nothing above medium risk that called for an audit. And why I'm particularly, and we all are particularly proud of this, is the two areas of risk that they identified were areas that we've identified already and taken action for. That was the quality of juvenile defense, which we've already made one of our priorities. And the other was the quality of post-conviction relief services. And we have proposed, and back to my discussion with Representative Hanna about a computer, here indeed we are asking for a computer to do that work better. We're willing to do it with an adequate budget. We will work on it anyway, but I'm saying that we have anticipated solutions to those two risks, which essentially the letter endorsed. They essentially took our strategies to address juvenile representation and post-conviction relief representation and said, go forward with those strategies. So I'm quite proud to say I think that's a stem-to-stern review of our agency by an outside group and essentially an endorsement that we're going in the right direction and doing a good job. So I did want to highlight that. And I think it goes to, you know, our commitment to performance and performance measures. Finally, and I, Madam Chair, I mentioned Senator Devlin. Senator Devlin, I had in mind.
There is a question from Representative.
I just want to ask, is the 765 included in the judicial branch recommended budget for the four in-house attorneys?
Yes, it is. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, again, I don't want to lose the thread of how many budgets we're talking about. Now I'm talking about the original Chief Justice's recommended budget, and then what, we don't have that in our appendix. What we have is after the governor cut 9% and took our policy packages away.
What I'm talking about is the judicial branch is recommended, which is part of this document, which we talked yesterday.
Yes.
By the way, we're going to get the spreadsheet with
and,
that.
And the total is about $186 million, if that's the number. And in there are our policy option packages. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks.
The only other thing I wanted to mention, as I was mentioning this, Senator Devlin, I had in mind the senator had a question about performance measures. I'd be happy to answer. The only other thing I wanted to talk about was the agency's commitment to diversity and cultural competence. I think we have a special challenge that we want to face, and I wanted to talk about that briefly, but that's pretty much all I had on my agenda, so other than questions. I am yours.
Senator Devlin, did you want to probe in the area of
Just briefly. And I think one of the things I wanted to recall was the meeting before the Legislative Audit Committee. And I think there were some interesting meetings. But I think part of the difficulty there was that the committee was searching for some additional performance measures, in the sense that, I mean, the original performance measures were good measures, actually, in a very real way, because I think it's important how your contracts are managed and what the relationship is with the contractors that you have, and how you're seeing that they are actually performing the responsibilities that you ask them to perform. So the committee was searching for additional performance measures. But obviously, I mean, at first, you know, people started to discuss, well, a lot of agencies, we have customer sort of approval ratings. Well, this is not particularly an entity that can go out and query their customer approval ratings in terms of the clients of indigent defense. So that was not really probably an appropriate measure, even though that was at first discussed for a few moments. The other measures that you've added in terms of complaints and whether those complaints are well-founded, I think, was one of the measures that came out of that discussion. I think we did take that on to one level, and I don't know if that's actually reflected in your final performance measures, but there may be reasons that it's not. And what we had discussed is that the number of cases where, in post-conviction relief, the courts find that counsel was inadequate or that an error was made by counsel. And, I mean, that is a complaint issue in a sense, but it's also literally an outside entity, in the sense the court system basically saying that the counsel was, for some reason, not what it should have been or the quality it should have been.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, respectfully, I hope you take this. As I remember, you were referring to the first meeting of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, and I was hoping, because you had a lot of ideas, and I know you reviewed our materials, I think you weren't able to make the second one.
Yeah, that's probably
we had quite a discussion, I wish you'd been there, about the Performance Measure 6, which was really, again, I didn't, in the first meeting, think I presented our thinking very well. I was trying to have a brainstorming session, and you know, you all are very busy and want some more guidance, and then the committee directed our agency to the Judiciary Committee. And then in that process, we refined our thinking, at least my presentation skills, and we talked more about this on-site visiting process. Right. And when we came back in the second meeting of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and explained it, I think the committee was pretty satisfied. But to get to your point about post-conviction relief, I think it's a very good point. And where we have decided to integrate it is at the site visit process. In other words, some of our very best contractors say we should be monitoring that as managers of our law firms and looking at our rate. And by the way, when we're saying post-conviction relief, just to remind you, this is the second level of appeal in which matters don't appear in the transcript to in front of the Chief Justice of the Court of Appeals. It's matters outside of what we call as lawyers the record. That's typically the competence of lawyers or something the prosecutor might have done. So post-conviction relief is really a check on the quality of the lawyers and the service we provide. So a manager of a law office ought to want to track that rate of post-conviction relief. Now, it may just be smoke, because we know that many of these charges, accusations, and post-conviction relief by an unhappy client are not well-founded. They're in the prison, and okay, they're not happy. But there are some that are meritorious, and we think, as part of our site visit, Senator Devlin, that we want to ask our managers, as part of their best practices, to track post-conviction relief performance, bar complaints, and then to add, perhaps, and I want to go very slowly with this because we don't want to overload them with things. I am going down for a personal trip to the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm visiting two of the oldest public defender systems in the country, Santa Clara County Public Defender and San Mateo County Private Defender. They have an appointment process. And both agencies have developed fairly refined and sophisticated measurements like acquittal rates. How above the going rate for plea bargain are we doing? In other words, are we getting standard or better than average results? And you can only do that in a county-by-county basis. I can't give you that information statewide because prosecutors' behaviors and policies vary among our 36 counties. My point is that I think there are a fair number of sophisticated measures that we can ask contractors to integrate, and we'll do that through the site visit process. So what we'll have for you is a report on probably an annual basis saying how many sites have we visited, what are now the sort of protocol that we're presuming that a good agency ought to adopt, and how many have adopted them. So, again, during that second meeting, there was quite a bit of discussion about that.
That's what I wanted to get on the record, though, also, Wes, is that that I thought that the first performance measures that you presented were reasonable measures. There are additional ones that we sought, and finally through the second committee meeting, those were approved. But I think that I just wanted to give you a very clear indication that I thought that your original measures were ones that you needed also. But we were struggling because,
yes,
you know, we're trying to think of outside the box a little bit of, you know, when we start to think about other agencies, it seems so easy what a performance measure should be. But obviously, we can't have performance measures tied to the satisfaction of your clients.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I appreciate that. And before you arrived today, I talked a little about my thinking about outputs and outcomes. And a lot of our measures looked output-y, if you will.
Yeah.
But I remember your comment at one of the meetings about this notion of client satisfaction. Actually, the research on clients, both in civil and criminal, indicate that clients are often not satisfied with the outcome of their lawyer, but they can set that outcome aside and fairly critique their lawyer. And the biggest problem criminal or civil clients have is their lawyer doesn't communicate with me. They don't explain the predicament I'm in. They don't talk to me in understandable language. They don't answer my phone calls. This is the classic private or public. And I think, and some of our contractors around the state are indeed surveying their clients and are finding that indeed the clients can set aside the fact that they generally have been convicted of a crime and fairly evaluate on the scale of responsiveness the clients. Now, I go visit the state prison fairly regularly, and there's an array of our clients who are very unhappy. I haven't yet decided how to survey them, but they tell me that they can set aside their unhappiness with the outcome and tell me when our lawyers are responsive or not. So I haven't given up. I'm not saying that will be a primary performance measure, but I think it's relevant to our evaluations.
Follow up?
Yeah. Just so the committee... one of the things, you know, all the safeguards in this system are very important, and I'm very supportive of all those safeguards. But the reality is, in terms of by the time someone gets either to trial, or they're, we'll take those that go to trial and those that are plea bargained to either some lesser offense or the offense actually that the district attorney sought and penalty, I would guess that by the time cases get to that level, probably in the, somewhere in the mid-90s, are either plea bargained out or they, if they go to trial, they're found guilty. Would that be a fair...
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I think it's in the mid-90s for plea bargaining, and then after that,
it's
outright acquittal is much smaller. I would venture it's in the single digit. Have you seen those numbers, Catherine?
Yeah.
I would say it's... Frankly, because, you know, we're in the business of assuring that innocent people aren't convicted, but if prosecutors are doing their jobs, they're not bringing lousy cases that they can't win or that are convicting innocent people. So we would expect a very low rate of acquittal. And that was a conversation, you may recall, we had with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. Should you be measuring your acquittal rate? My answer now is, yes, at the local level, we should track that and ask our lawyers at the local level, contractor by contractor, are we doing that? But at the statewide level, the numbers are so small, and again, policies vary from county to county, that I don't think it would be a meaningful measure for us or you. But final point I would make, absent questions, is that this is an ongoing process, as I'm sure it is with many agencies. We want to assure you that we will be back to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, this committee, and others with additional performance measures when we think they help us and you assure that you're getting what you're paying for.
Mr. Roseanne, if there are no further questions or comments on performance measures, I'd like to move us toward your conclusion. You were going to speak to us about the agency's commitment to promoting diversity and cultural competence, supplementing the text that starts on page 15.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did want to speak to this, and I have been pretty much laid it out in writing, but our clients are incredibly diverse and increasingly diverse as our population is, diversifies, if you will. And it's incumbent on us, it seems to me, to struggle like all agencies to try to make our workforce look more like our client base. I have to say that we have a huge barrier to entry or problems with that in the legal profession. 30 years ago, I helped develop the affirmative action training program at the University of Oregon and have been committed to that over those years, but our success rate is reasonably low, in my opinion, in terms of bringing people of color and diversity into the legal profession. Many people are trying, the chief most notable among them and many others, to do that. There is, as some of you know, a very controversial article that's in the Stanford Law Review this month that's been covered by a number of journals in which a law professor at University of Southern California has posited that affirmative action in the legal education area has actually set back the mission of getting lawyers of color into the legal profession. And it's very controversial, but it simply shows us that the thinking on this subject is an ongoing process. I say all that to say that we in some ways are really limited by the number of people of color and diversity that come into the legal profession that we can therefore recruit. We are doing a number of things. I suppose among them is since I was once a member of the club of faculty, I go to certainly my former colleagues at the University of Oregon Law School and to other law schools and tell them, look, we can offer lawyers, good young lawyers, particularly lawyers of color if they're interested, an opportunity in an atmosphere where they can feel like they're contributing. And I try to recruit, before anybody else does, those students. just like one would recruit for athletes or whatever. But, as you can imagine, we're incredibly limited. For one reason is they come out with averaging $70,000 to $100,000 in law school debt, and we're offering them $38,000, $40,000, $35,000. Some legal secretaries make more than that in the private sector, so it's very hard. We'll continue to do it. I've outlined some of the strategies, which I think is close to working in the law school level. You know, it's not only, I don't think we'll ever collectively as a society make major progress unless we all recognize that diverse communities and diverse workforces are good places to work for those of us who are in the majority. I think we have that attitude in our agency. I think we are a place that is conducive to, at the state level in our agency, conducive to diversity. But in the meantime, in terms of what do we do beyond recruitment and our, I think we'll have to say, limited success, what can we do for what I call cultural competence, which is lawyers like me, white, middle-aged, or most often younger than me, who don't come from communities of color, who don't come from the same background, but represent people of diverse backgrounds. What do we do to attune those lawyers to the differences in the way people process information, the way they value outcomes, what they consider as a good and a bad outcome? And I think, and I've been a bit presumptuous to talk to my colleagues in the public defense community, I don't think as a community we do enough and we think enough about, hard enough about this. Why? Because I think there's a certain view that we're already doing the work of the angels. We already are representing the downtrodden and the poor. Why would you ask us to do more? And I think there is a certain failure to really look hard at that issue. In a five-year study that I was involved in Multnomah County, where we looked at the issue of overrepresentation of people in color in the criminal justice system, I had a working hypothesis that I thought perhaps the discussions among clients of color and their public defense attorneys was a point where decisions were made that perhaps contributed to overrepresentation. I couldn't document it, but it looked to me like it was, again, a gap in culture. From a young 17-year-old, say, African-American, Latino, Russian, whatever, you can pay, has a different attitude about the law, about the consequences of the law, than a white, middle-class, legally trained lawyer. And if you don't understand those differences, the advice you give your client is going to be affected. So I think we need to look deeply at that, and we need to do it with training among ourselves. We need to do, and we've already started the idea of appointing a group called a diversity task force, which will be made up largely of lawyers of color, but not necessarily, to simply have these conversations, because I mentioned to you the five-year study in Multnomah County. It really took us over a year to be able to talk about race openly. We can't do that very well, race and ethnicity in our culture. And so as lawyers, we need to start talking about it, and then we need to start training ourselves. And I think a lot of the training would have to be in that area of advising clients. How do you, you know, inform your clients? How do you keep them suspended before they make a judgment? How do you work those decisions about whether they're going to plead guilty, go into drug treatment? I think there are many lawyers who do it well. I'm risking being presumptuous to lecture to the defense community, but it's something that I feel committed, and enough lawyers with a lot more recent experience than I think that this is worth doing. So I think our big gain is in cultural competence. We'll continue to work on diversity, but in the meantime, hey, this is Oregon. Look at we are becoming more diverse, but still the lawyers are not, but we need to become more culturally competent. So that's my pledge to you, to say that we are working on it. We have people like Ingrid Swenson, who's the general counsel, who's worked in Multnomah County, who's committed to it. I know many lawyers in John Potter's organization are committed to it.
Appreciate very much hearing your thoughts about work in this area. Appreciate your pledge, and you can count on my personal support, and I know the support of others on the committee to assist you in your work around diversity and affirmative action, cultural competence. It's been my personal experience that in the area of recruitment and retention of professionals in any arena, professionals of color in particular, the quality of our relationships, the quality of personal relationships, is the key to success. And I know that you know that, and I'm just saying it out loud. And I appreciate that that is driving, that knowledge is driving some of the work that you are doing. I'm noting that you have bulleted developing personal relationships with the criminal law faculties of law schools to identify students, and et cetera, added to other comments you've already made. The other thing I want to say to you as we move toward closure of your presentation today, I want to go back to the discussion that we've had around performance measures, and when we get to phase two, we'll be taking up that discussion again. But the quality of information and discussion around the performance measures has been outstanding, in my view. And I also want to say that the information that you have provided in text form to support your thinking, reasoning behind the performance measures has also been very, very, very clear and very helpful to this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that said, I'd ask if other committee members have comments.
I just have and I want to go back to your diversity task force, and you talked about bringing in other members of the legal community of color. You may want to think in terms of also adding a public of color. And I say that because often as professional groups, we talk to ourselves. And sometimes we don't get that other dimension or that other input that sometimes is very valuable that we need in order to really get the reality of the whole issue. I hear, you know, sometimes particularly from various groups that what you hear, that they don't believe that their attorney is listening to them, and normally it is because of the difference in how maybe one says things, how one hears things, you know, the vernacular in the community that I came from in Portland, one word may mean something different than what that person who went through the educational system. And there's a street language and there is a non-street language, and we tend to forget those languages when we're representing individuals. And so I would just kind of ask you to look at that particular piece as you, and I think it's a good idea when you talk about this task force that you're talking about putting together. I recall one year when we were working on some of the same issues in with counselors and others at Hillcrest and McLaren, and I believe it was the Western Institute of Higher Ed came in and did some work with us. And one of the things they did that was very, very helpful for the professional group, they actually brought in the some of the youth whom the staff had responsibility for. It was a huge eye-opener for the professional staff to hear from the other side of what they had communicated to them and what they understood. And it was also a huge eye-opener for them to leave and to suddenly see, here are these individuals that we were in charge of, here are these individuals that we thought we were helping, and here's what they actually thought of what we were doing. And that's a piece that sometimes is hard for us as professionals to take, but I think in part of this process of trying to better understand and to build a relationship to move through this process might be one that you might want to take a look at adding that dimension to your
Madam Chair,
questions.
Senator Winters, an excellent idea. In fact, my experience in that regard inspired me to pursue this a little more. There's an agency association on a national level called the National Legal Aid and Defenders Association. Legal aid are the lawyers who provide services, as you probably all know, to civil to clients who have civil problems, housing, landlord-tenant, typically some divorce, people without means, and then, of course, the defenders community. When I go to those national conferences, the legal aid are far more sophisticated and inclusive. They have something, like you're suggesting, client counsels, former clients of the firms. Now, I think there are opportunities here because not all the clients that we have are still in state prison. Many have rehabilitated themselves or out leading law-abiding lives. So I very much agree with you. We need to find, and of course, if any of you have suggestions of people you know who from your communities it would be good to include, I welcome them. So we certainly will do that.
Ms. Lamont, any closing comments or guidance for the committee?
I'm actually, Madam Chair, rather speechless. I think that this dialogue has been unusual and very helpful. We obviously have a significant chore in front of us as a committee in terms of how we are going to ultimately end up dealing with the shortfall that we have in this budget and the decisions that have to be made about how all of these issues are integrated into how you handle the public safety system. That, of course, has been the message all the way through.
Madam Chair, if you just permit me one other thing, I really appreciated all of your questions and your courtesy. And it's the same for any agency head. It's daunting. I mean, we are actually a little agency with a big budget, and I could talk about privatization and what we've done. But when I come here, as conducive as it is, it's daunting. I feel like there's the fate of our 60 employees, our 1,000 lawyers, our 1,000 clients on how I communicate to you about these concerns. And I hope in my enthusiasm I haven't lectured you. That wasn't my intent. I do fear, I want to say this finally, not just for the agency and my clients. And
hold your thought just for a moment, because I want to make sure that Senator Devlin and Senator Winters hear what you want to share.
I fear for Oregon, actually, right now, for a couple of reasons. If we return to that reference to BRAC, that shortfall. Again, I'm talking about right-sizing. I happen to be a friend of mine is in the hospital in San Francisco. He's a law school classmate, and I was down there last week. And it was an occasion for a number of my classmates from law school to get together and compare notes and from around the country. Most of them weren't in criminal law. One was the CEO of a Fortune 2000 firm. Another was general counsel of a software company in Palo Alto. All of them said we heard Oregon was a state that shut down its public safety system a year or so ago. And that's when I go out and talk to other criminal justice communities. These folks weren't in them. The word has gotten out. We talk about, you know, the schools and being the butt of jokes on comic strips. But the word is getting out that we may shut down our public safety system. And all my plea is to you is we can get along with less resources, again, if the place is right-sized. Just I urge you, I implore you, to not downsize one component of these moving parts. Without otherwise, we will be in that same position, whether it's indigent defense or the forensic. And we will be the butt of jokes on a national level. That's my closing comment. Whether it's us or somebody else, whether it's the courts, I urge you that if you're going to have to shrink proportionately, and we will help you do that, but don't just take a cut out of one of us.
We will remember the hydraulics. Representative Lisner.
Madam Chair, on behalf of the committee, I would ask you to please express our appreciation for the Chief Justice's time he spent here. It brought to me and really gave his support and emphasis, and he spent a lot of time. I'm sure he's a very busy gentleman.
Absolutely.
Chief,
as always, it's wonderful to have your presence
but always also the quality of your participation in this process with us. We do look forward to meeting with you or those that you would designate in the department soon, this week, Friday I'm told, to start unpacking the Judicial Department details. But again, thank you very much for your presence.
Thank you, Ms.
Elbert. Thank you so much. Representative Hannah.
This can be a parting comment, but yes. I'm hopeful just in housekeeping before Phase 2 comes around that we will get this document that includes the Chief Justice or the Judicial Branch recommended budget spreadsheet, because Senate Bill 5525 is built on that number, not these numbers, and it would be very helpful for homework basis that we had that as soon as practicable.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what I will, since that's an LFO document that's published, I will work with Catherine Aylward to get you the spreadsheet that's like the one that the Judicial Branch and Judicial Department gave you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hannah. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roseanne. Ms. Elwood.
Madam Chair, apologize for your two delinquent members.
Members, we're just going to be at ease. We'll be at ease for about 3 minutes. Debt Services Commission and open a hearing on House Bill 5061, which is the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. We will be hearing an agency overview and discussing performance measures discussion led by Director John Hennis. Welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate it. Members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee, Public Safety. My name is John Menace. I am the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Seated to my right is Mr. Bill McGee, who is the VAM analyst who's assigned to our agency.
Mr. Menace, we want to draw your attention to Ms. Public Safety Piggy, also known as PS Piggy, and your reference to
Budget and Management
has been duly noted by the Sergeant at Arms. We're coming out to collect. Okay.
Madam Chair, I assume
he has great expectations.
I did bring a lot of wine, too. I was forewarned, so I have no excuse, Madam Chair.
The Oregon Food Bank will thank you. Please continue and just lay out for us where you would like to go in the time that we have to start your presentation this afternoon. We have about 35 minutes.
All right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, as you are, I'm sure, painfully aware, since you've been engaged in these overviews for quite a while, the agencies were required to prepare presentations based on a series of phases, phase 1, 2, and 3. The agency supplied for you an outline, phase 1, which, of course, is the agency's overview, mission goals, historical perspective, and affirmative action information. So I'd like to start with section 1 of that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the mission of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, otherwise known as DPSST, is to promote excellence in public safety through the development of professional standards and the delivery of quality training. On that particular point, I'd like to mention that standards is the enforcement side of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The delivery of training is, of course, the bulk of our mission, and a core mission primarily being law enforcement. I think when most people think of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, they think that it is the police academy. With that, I want to mention to you that we really have a large sphere of individual organizations and groups that we train. About 60% of the agency's funding goes to train the Department of Corrections or corrections officers in sheriff's departments around the state. So contrary to the concept that we are the police academy, we are, however, we're much broader than that. Our goals are, not listed in any particular order, but the completion of the construction of the core facility to accommodate a multidisciplinary training needs of all of the various organizations that we serve, but primarily the police academy, which is at the real core of the development of that facility. The complete development and implementation of the 16-week basic police course, which is an ongoing review of our existing 10-week curriculum, and interaction between our staff and the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training, who we also serve, and subcommittee curriculum committees that have been created within the five different policy committees to review various curriculum. So it's a relatively complex undertaking, but it is designed to bring the various customers within our organization, those we serve, to the table so that they can participate in the ultimate outcome of the training and clearly also the standards that we enforce. The third is the effective integration of the Oregon State Police Academy into our basic police training academy. That is an ongoing discussion between the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and the superintendent of the Oregon State Police. And we have had some fruitful discussions leading up to the potential integration of the two academies. Also, to obtain resources and recruit qualified staff to meet operational requirements and carry out our training objectives. On this particular point, it has been a challenge for the agency to recruit and maintain qualified staff, given the complex nature of the agency's mission and also the various pool from which we are able to recruit qualified candidates. I think it's important to point out on this point that we are not able to hire brand new police officers or brand new firefighters or brand new corrections officers as agency employees to become qualified subject matter experts and trainers within our agency. We have to recruit from literally proselytize from other police agencies or fire agencies or folks that have qualified highly skilled subject matter experts and individuals who are qualified to train. So it has been an ongoing and constant challenge for the agency to compete, both in terms of salary and other issues that you'll hear about, I'm sure, later. The restoration and expansion delivery of regional criminal justice training, that is, a heart issue. As I have traveled around the state of Oregon and spoke with chiefs and sheriffs, the regional training component of our agency, which is existing component part of our agency, is something that is highly valued by our constituents and something that they are clearly asking more from, and it's a challenge for the agency to continue to do that, but it is also a very fulfilling endeavor for the agency to try to meet those needs. As many of the agencies around the state are very small agencies. And in fact, I did bring with me today, I wanted to kind of point out, we're going to try to supply these for the committee through the cooperation of the Oregon Chiefs of Police Association or Association of Chiefs of Police. It's basically a directory of police agencies around the state, but inside you'll see the size of the various agencies and the budgets that they have for their agencies. And just an example, Madam Chair, is Amity Police Department has a population, the city has a population of 1,487 based on this particular directory's information. They have three sworn officers and a budget of $150,000 for the entire police department. And there are many, many agencies throughout the state that are similarly situated. So it's very important to put in context who many of those agencies are and why their expectations of this agency are so high with respect to the delivery of regional training. Many of these folks cannot, by and large, afford to send their people on a fee basis. I know that that's been an issue that's been brought up from time to time. Why don't agencies pay for the training? If you could see, just based on Amity with a budget of $150,000 and an average cost per student going through the police training program of $12,500, it's a pretty substantial impact for many of the small agencies, so it's a burden. In addition to that, the restoration and expansion and delivery of fire training. This is an area that Deputy Director Eric Gablis is better qualified to speak to, but it's also important for me to note to the committee that 90-95% of the firefighters in the state of Oregon are volunteers who serve their communities without remuneration at all. And the standards that they and training that they subject themselves to is of course accomplished in the context of their weekends and evenings that they dedicate to their community. Our agency is the primary supplier of regional training fire services for these organizations, and they depend on our delivery of those services to help make them proficient and literally be able to save lives within their community.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Director Minnis, do we not have any fire training now that is being provided?
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Wisner. There is fire training provided in the major metropolitan police, fire agencies like the Portland Fire Bureau of Eugene, I mean, Salem, have their own training components. Chemeketa Community College has a fire training program that's accomplished at the community college level within the state of Oregon. But I think, and I might drag Eric's up here because I think he can better answer the question, but I do believe that most of the, at least initial training for a lot of the volunteer firefighters does come through our agency.
Now please turn that microphone directly toward... Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wisner, Director Minnis is correct, and let me elaborate a little further if I could.
I was going to say, please identify.
Sorry. I'm sorry. Eric Galvis, Deputy Director at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The fire programs at the department work in partnership with not only over 300 fire departments that are rural fire protection districts and city fire departments, but also 22 regional fire training associations that are geographically based. What our fire training staff does is work with those fire training associations in really a combination on how to best deliver services to each of those areas. A good example may be an area you're all familiar with, the Portland metropolitan area. Most of the fire departments there are career fire departments that do have an in-house training component. But an opposite example would be the Columbia Gorge, where we work with Wasco County, which has 11 or 12 fire departments that may not even be government entities. They may be a nonprofit neighborhood group that has set up a fire department, and our trainers have gone in and worked with those agencies to deliver training to them around their schedule. There is no paid employee there to deliver that training, so our staff are almost de facto training officers for those departments, and there are dozens of fire departments like that across the state that truly have no one in-house. Their fundraising is by car washes and bake sales and those kind of things just to raise enough funds to purchase apparatus or equipment. So we provide them with the training, again, in partnership with the Regional Training Association, where we can bring people in to help them out as well.
Follow on, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I know we have community colleges, and they have fire training programs. And I know we have the National Fire Institute back in Pennsylvania or Maryland. But so we're saying, are we taking this on as a new responsibility? The state's going to provide these people and not going to charge them any fees? It's like...
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, the answer is yes and no. Right now, the department does provide training that we do not charge a fee for to these fire departments. Last year, I believe we delivered over 300 classes across the state to over 3,000 firefighters. We do not charge a fee for that. We are also the state's connection to the National Fire Academy in Emmitsburg, Maryland. The National Fire Academy is very beneficial to Oregonians in three ways. One is that the National Fire Academy exports classes to our department that we then deliver across the state, either directly or through handoff classes. The National Fire Academy also exports 9 classes a year to the state, and this past weekend is a good example. We brought those 9 classes into the academy in Monmouth, and we hosted what we call Winter Fire School. We had just under 300 students from across the state come in and take those National Fire Academy classes for no fee, and then they were able to go back and basically use those skills at their department, whether it was leadership, arson detection, public education. And then the third, and perhaps one of the invisible parts of the National Fire Academy, is that we are the broker of National Fire Academy resident courses back in Emmitsburg. A volunteer firefighter from Oregon can go back to the National Fire Academy if you're selected to a 6-day class for no fee other than the cost of meals while they're there. Those are our tax dollars at the federal level basically going to the fire service. Career fire departments also have the same opportunity. However, those classes are 2 weeks in length, so we do broker those classes here. But quite honestly, a lot of agencies don't know that, so we spend a lot of time marketing those services to the fire service. The other part, Representative Wisner, that's the other part of your question, is that we do have a number of community colleges that have good fire service programs. The challenge is that the majority of those programs are aimed at people who want to be a career firefighter or a paramedic. So really the community college system, although it's very flexible, their main goal is to develop people who want to do that as a career, not to do a 4-hour class or a 2-hour class for a firefighter in a rural community. There's just not enough supply for the demand.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you. I think as we get down closer to ground level, we'll be looking at this more. I think especially in rural eastern Oregon, this is a real problem, and it's one of our primary public safety issues is firefighting and having the capability. So I also want to be sure that we're not duplicating and adding on. If we're doing something here to help provide that public safety, that's good. But I'm sure we'll have further time to look at that as we get into the phase two. So thank you for asking, allowing me.
And continue asking questions, Representative. Please continue.
Madam Chair, I just do want to add one bit of clarification that Mr. McGee...
Microphone,
sorry,
please.
Mr. McGee pointed out to me that the fire service program is paid for by the fire insurance premium tax revenue stream. So it is an independent revenue stream that, quite frankly, I think more qualified people to speak to this, but I think the analysis is that it's a fairly healthy stream of revenue at this point. And I think what you'll generally find is that the need is much, much greater than our ability right now to supply adequate, competent training to these professionals. The other area that's not necessarily was not mentioned is in some situations, the agency has been called in when we have large fires or forested areas, to train National Guard personnel in a moment's notice to try to help them do the wildland fire management programs and such. So, and that's a constant need because obviously the fire season does change from time to time, and there certainly when there is a large fire, there's a need for well-trained individuals who can do fire suppression safely.
Good. Missed that follow-up to that, Matt.
Certainly.
I think that's important, and I'd like to maybe that should be one of your goals or put that on there as a mission that you are using the Guard, because I know as a taxpayer, I think that's good. Of course, right now they're fighting other battles, and hopefully that'll end soon that they can come back and help us with that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Thank you for the question. Continuing on down to my list of goals, the restoration of the accreditation process that would ensure professional standards are met during training delivery. This is actually an area of the agency that is in need because we get a substantial number of requests from various entities that would like our agency to accredit their training programs so that they might be recognized by the agency, and it's one of our objectives. Developing partnerships and technology-based training capabilities to provide alternative training methodologies or delivery systems. We're exploring with Chemeketa Community College and other groups to try to determine whether or not there's some course content that we can develop into CD-based programs and develop for broadcast around the state for statewide training or regional-type training programs and doing it in a more cost-efficient way and doing so substantially. The agency has had at least an attempt in the past to try to do that, but unfortunately the outcome was not very successful. But there is that's a developing technology, and there are many people now who are at least willing to help us to begin to move down that direction. And I think as we expand towards the 16-week Police Training Academy program, we are internally discussing issues relevant to how we can get course materials in the hands of the Academy students before they actually show up on our doorstep, and perhaps even asking them to do some study prior to arriving so that they're ready to learn when we get to the new facility. It's going to be a constant or continued challenge for us to meet the needs at a 16-week basic training level. I think I alluded in a previous discussion before this committee that when we finally do get to 16 weeks, we'll be 6 weeks behind the national average for basic training programs in the police category. So we are going to have to rely on partnerships and technology, I think, to help expand our abilities to deliver the services that we are being asked to deliver.
Director Menace, it would be helpful to hear at this stage when you expect to get to the 22 weeks, if not today, just know that that's a discussion that we need to have in terms of the planning to get there, the strategies to get there, what the funding will need to be to get there. Again, we're in the process of doing some restorations and et cetera, but we're still, even after we do that, we're still not going to be where we want to be in terms of providing
a quality of training that is that meets the national standard.
Madam Chair, I'm glad that you brought that issue up, because at this point we actually do not have a plan to move to 22 weeks, but I would like to mention to the committee that there are really some stressors when we begin to have that discussion, because in the rural communities right now, the agencies will send their folks to our department for 10 weeks to do the basic training program. What you need to understand is they are on the agency's dime, both agencies, the agency that is sending the student to our academy. They are paying the salaries and benefits of the officer while they're in the academy. The state is picking up the cost for the training while they're at the academy. Many of these small agencies, again, are picking up salaries. It's a very difficult financial situation for them to be in, having someone gone for 10 weeks. So now that we're going to move to 16, it becomes an exacerbating factor to many of these smaller agencies. You then move to 22, it becomes even more complex and more difficult.
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin, and then Representative Hanna, and then Representative Wisnott.
Another complication to that, Director Minnis, is what we commonly hear from smaller municipalities is that they send their people off to be trained. They pay for their salary, and then they work for them a year or two, and then the first law enforcement position that opens up in a place that pays more reasonably, they're off. So it becomes a very difficult decision for a small community, and one that probably I'm not going to even venture this out onto the table in a real sense, but have we ever, I'm not planning on proposing any legislation. Former Senator Minnis was very good at proposing legislation. I once had a half-page bill that came into his committee that came out 30 pages long, which wasn't bad, actually.
Legislation that
agreed with most. But part of this, I wonder if we should, even for some smaller jurisdictions, have even a greater role, in a sense that maybe we should have some classes where we potentially select the applicants, where BPSST, I know I owe a dollar, where we run the class and where we basically try to channel people into various agencies. I know large law enforcement agencies and, you know, sheriffs probably would have some problems with that, but I think small law enforcement agencies would probably be benefited by more adequate screening, by basically, you know, running classes and basically maybe not having to pay as much for people going through the program as they do now, in the sense of paying the full freight for the, if there's a job at the end of this, I think there's some people that might work for a little bit less. But that's never been a really approach, and I'm not going to put it on the table. I'm not proposing a bill, but I think it is something that, it's interesting. I don't know if any other states do anything like that, because we are a state of so many small municipalities in reality.
Madam Chair, Senator, you raised some very, very fine points. They are challenges for smaller agencies. There are some smaller agencies who have tried to address the issue that you mentioned of putting the money and the investment into training a new officer by having an employment contract with the new officer. That, in essence, in at least one successful incident where a person was hired, entered into a contract, came to our academy, the agency, and his home agency and our agency spent a lot of money to train them. They then did exactly what you said. It took another job with another agency. The chief of that organization pointed out that you are in violation of your contract, and hence you owe us the cost of your training. That person resisted paying. The agency sued and was successful in defending that employment contract. So some of the smaller agencies are being more innovative. But our agency, I do agree with you, we also need to be innovative in developing partnerships and working with as many of the communities as we can. We're attempting to do that through a number of venues. One, in the correction side, given, as I think you already heard, the Department of Corrections preliminary budget. I do it again.
I'm out of one, so I have to be more careful. So,
in the instance of the Department of Corrections, we have held a basic academy
training program for corrections officers in Ontario at the community college and in cooperation with the community college there. We're currently in discussions with the Department of Corrections to attempt to put together a basic corrections training program in Lakeview, where they're having some very difficult challenges trying to staff that that particular facility. We're looking at that in terms of our cash flow and whether or not we want to underwrite it. As it looks, I think our preliminary information tells us that it would cost us money to hold that training program at Lakeview. So the director of the department and I need to sit down and talk about the cash flow issue relevant to that. But he does have some serious challenges in recruitment, retention, and training to get that facility started up, and we are trying to meet those needs. I guess my strategy, Madam Chair, with respect to how do we get more training delivered to folks who need the training to get to the 22 weeks would be through strategies like delivering material before individuals actually attend the academy. And actually, we learned this from the Department of State Police. They actually do deliver some core materials, course materials, and an expectation regarding their physical fitness to them before they arrive at the most recent academy that they held at Camp Rylea, and asking that they study. There are areas like criminal law, criminal procedure, some of these things are just book learning that we can actually send to these folks and have them study before they come in. We're also doing some fairly innovative things with the physical fitness component part of the agency, the Oregon ORPAT, Oregon
Physical Ability Test.
Oregon Physical Oregon Physical Abilities Test, and looking and making that an employment standard. If we do make an employment standard of it, or the board makes that as an employment standard, then what we would like to do is ask community colleges and others to participate in helping to train to the Oregon Physical Abilities Test, because as you may know, folks coming into law enforcement oftentimes start out in good physical condition at the end of their careers, like me. They've thickened a little bit, perhaps aren't as quick and fast as they used to be, because age has a tendency to take the better of us. But what research does tell us is that where individuals who currently exercise and have athletic backgrounds and skills, when they have been trained to do so at the beginning of their careers, they tend to continue that throughout their careers and hence tend to be healthier and are not a drain on the health systems also. So one of our objectives is to try to deliver that training. I guess the bottom line is I'd like to be able to deliver some of those trainings before and then subsequently through regional training delivery systems, additional training in the regions locally, rather than retaining those individuals at the Salem site for longer than 16 weeks, if we can.
Representative Hanna.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Devlin and yourself both touched on issues that I think are worth talking about. But to the point of, I wondered, do the collective bargaining units get in the way of or impede in some way having employment services contracts? If the small municipalities say, look, we want to have somebody come to the training site and we're going to pay for them to be there and so on, can they have an agreement that says, you know, you're going to put 24 months in with our agency after completing that? Does that get in the way? Or,
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I have not heard of any obstacles relevant to collective bargaining agreements, but I do imagine that it could become a topic of their discussions. Frankly, I'm not sure the represented groups from the smaller cities and counties, and not meaning any disrespect, they probably tend not to carry the same level of clout that larger police unions do, like the Portland Police Association or the Oregon State Police Officers Association.
Just as a follow-up to that comment, and I know lots of the law enforcement folks in Douglas County and whatnot, and I think what tends to happen, and it could happen in any professional training situation, is you take someone from a smaller community, you combine them in class with members of other communities or agencies, and they all sit around and talk shop when the training's over, and pretty soon, gee, you make another 10 grand a year working over here, and we're getting the same training, so why don't you come over here? I mean, they sort of self-recruit. And to prevent some of that, you could have, employment services agreement. Now, the second part of that is, as Senator Devlin talked about just a little bit, is, and maybe as time goes with the new training facility, in a sense, you have an opportunity to put people in the queue. I mean, you have that chance to go do some of what Senator Gordley spoke of, some of the screening and pre-applicant work, and the benefit to the smaller communities is,
rather than them having to pay up front or investment spend on those people. You do that a little bit up front, and they get to pay when you're done, in a sense, because you have a few people in the queue, and so maybe down the road that'll be an opportunity.
Madam Chair, thank you for saying that. I think that's true. There are probably some opportunities. Mary Botkin whispered in Mr. Gablett's ear that apparently you can agree to anything you want in a collective bargaining agreement, and she has more experience there than I do. So we'll see.
Okay.
Representative Wisnan is in the queue, and then Senator.
Madam Chair, my issues have been addressed. Thank you.
All right. Senator.
I just wanted to comment briefly that I think that the people that are within those collective bargaining units would be relatively smart and would realize that if they had a small law enforcement agency that was sending people to be trained and they were leaving after only 2 years, it would leave less dollars available to that small community for whatever their compensation packages is. So they would have an interest, actually, in retaining those law enforcement officers just as much as the governments and those city councils and chiefs of police in those areas would have.
Right. No, Chair, thank you. I think you're absolutely right. I was just making a note to myself to mention that as you're thinking about this particular agency and budgets and the challenges that we're talking about during the weekend, take a look at the Oregonian WAN ads or look at your local WAN ads for people going into law enforcement, public safety careers. If you recall the previous discussion that we had before, I mentioned the NIJ study, the National Institute of Justice, that on a national basis there are there's a smaller pool of people migrating into law enforcement, public safety careers on a national level. And we're going to get to some issues a little later about, you know, minority recruiting and the aspect of bringing, minorities into the career field. As that pool gets smaller, those challenges become greater. It becomes even greater to smaller communities. But look in the newspaper, because what you'll see more often than not from my prior agency, the Portland Police Bureau, is they're accepting lateral transfers. What a lateral transfer means is somebody who's already been trained by the agency and is certified by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Those individuals do have a high value for employers. They're also a known quantity in the career field, so they have a reputation, and they do become very valuable to other police agencies, and hence will move. And that is a constant battle that the department faces in meeting those challenges and those needs.
In the 7 minutes we have remaining for today, Director Minnis, can you take us through the remaining goals?
I can, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, and I'll try to expedite this. Continuing the development of curricula for all disciplines and ensure examinations are defensible and accurately measure training objectives. This is a key area that is really hidden behind the sentence, is that what we teach is oftentimes challenged in court. And oftentimes we'll get a call from a defense attorney or somebody who's saying that they want to know what curriculum we're teaching with respect to the use of force. They'll want to know whether we're teaching taser, or whether we're teaching the use of a baton or some other kind of a defense mechanism, and so on and so forth. And those become issues in court. What we try to do through a job task analysis and through the use of Lorraine Engelmeyer and other people who analyze our legal issues is try to make sure that what we're teaching is legally sufficient and defensible when we ultimately get into court. In fact, we're constantly battling some of those things, because occasionally our instructors like to throw a little bit of additional material into their courses that perhaps isn't part of the course objectives. And so if we inadvertently are teaching somebody to beat someone over the head with a flashlight because some instructor has not followed the protocols, it becomes an ultimate potential liability issue for our agency, and also for that agency who ultimately hires that person, because they turn around and say the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training told us that it was legitimate to hit somebody over the head with a flashlight. Now, that's not a real experience. That's just an example that I've thrown out there. So we do need to look at the curriculum, make sure that we're teaching it as it is designed and that it is legally defensible, and that our instructors are proficient and capable of teaching to those curricula.
And so this is something that you're working toward, not quite achieved yet. Well, I guess I'm asking.
It's a good question, Madam Chair.
On what ground are we standing today?
Madam Chair, I think Eric can chime in at any moment. I think that it's a constant struggle for the agency. I think we'll get into in the this agency's been asked to present before the House Judiciary Committee's Criminal Law Subcommittee on what we teach relevant to use of force. That issue is a very hot topic, not only in Oregon, but around the country. And there are some things that we can talk about specific to that, relevant to what the training either is or is not. I can tell you that, you know, given in some cases it has to do with the de minimis amount of training time that we have. It also has to do with the absence of adequate research or adequate information on training techniques that are, in fact, more appropriately used in police training situations. And let me give you an example of that. When I went through the basic training program in 1977, it was then 8 weeks. We had mostly academic classes where we sat in a classroom with an instructor talking to us. We had a couple of days, I think, one day at the firing range, we had one day in an emergency vehicle operation, and maybe one day doing traffic stops. What this agency is trying to do and what the justification is for having the facility that we're building in the first place is we're trying to migrate from the classroom lecture environment to an actual hands-on experience, what you're going to experience on the street as close as we possibly can, so that these people will literally be able to, in their subconscious memory, know that they can survive some of these situations. And that means in some instances we're shooting them with CONSIM rounds, or they're wearing protective gear and so on and so forth, but the objective is to help them train in circumstances that are as close to real as possible. And we also know, for instance, that there are training techniques that we're not currently able to train because of the limited time, and we have to develop much of that curriculum so that we're able to do it in the scenario. We have to develop the scenarios, for instance. That's part of one of our challenges between now and when we open up the 16 weeks is actually having scenarios that we have tested and have also made sure that we're integrating many of the topics that you want integrated into these training scenarios. So the bottom line, Madam Chair, is that it is a constant battle and we have a lot of work to do. And I'll give you just an example of when I became director of the agency. I had one chief of police from an unknown eastern Oregon city who asked me what we were teaching with respect to defense tactics, because this particular chief of police had a challenge on his hands, and that was that a recent graduate from our academy made a traffic stop of a DUII situation, was in the process of arresting the driver. The passenger interfered, was asking perhaps some legitimate questions like, what are you going to do with this person and where is he going and so on and so forth. And based on this officer's statement to his chief and based on our training, he took this person down to the ground in what we teach is a ground fighting technique, handcuffed him and took him to jail. Well, the problem for the chief is it was the mayor's son. The question the chief had for us is, do you teach anything in between mere conversation and dumping somebody on their face and taking them to jail? And I said, well, let me get back with you on that. I need to check. Because clearly what we do want to be able to teach are alternatives and alternative strategies that do not take people from our basic training program from a mere conversation situation to, you know, bingo, bango, bongo. It's you're on the ground being handcuffed. We want our folks that are graduating to be better balanced, have a better foundation, and know that there are intermediary positions and other strategies that they can utilize, like verbal judo. Sometimes backing away from a confrontation, because in some instances, as I've reviewed some of our training, we have taught some very aggressive training methodologies, and we're trying to back away from some of those things and reevaluate whether or not those techniques are in fact appropriate. And I know that the director of the Department of Corrections met with me shortly after I arrived there and shortly after I had one of our defense tactics training programs evaluated by an outside source, who sat down with me and said, John, your agency is not teaching defense tactics consistent with our philosophy. And he's absolutely right. We weren't teaching it, and we aren't teaching it because we were not teaching it at the time. Our objective and my intent as the agency director is to be sensitive to those issues and make sure that we are hopefully responding and receiving that kind of criticism so that we're not training in ways that are inconsistent with community expectations.
I'm going to stop you there for today, and we will pick up on this conversation beginning tomorrow. I'd ask you to come back to us tomorrow and talk about
where Oregon, as we look at these goals, and we look at your mission, tell us where Oregon fits in the national scheme of things. I'm assuming that some state or states have, I'm going to call it the 21st century model for providing training in all of these areas. What are those states? I'll stop there and pick up the conversation tomorrow. Are there any other comments or questions?
Pat, here.
Senator Williams.
I think that the good senator to my right and I have a special request of the director whom we served with for several sessions and who had very good at producing legislation and very skilled at cutting through problems and bringing them to fruition to get things across this building. And I'm just wondering, in light of the situation that we're in and looking at budgets, what kind of counsel would he give us in looking at some of those pieces of legislation that he introduced over time, and whether there's any savings or anything in them that as we go through this process?
Madam Chair, I'm speechless.
Well, Madam Chair, that is a request from Senator Winters. I didn't want to in any way say that I was displeased by. I was surprised. We had a little half-page bill that was a good bill, actually. But I was actually kind of pleased that I ended up basically with the omnibus crime bill of the session.
We're just gesturing to our, just so that the House members know, one of our fellow colleagues whom we respect a lot. And
Representative Hannah, what is being said here, if I may interpret Representative Hannah, Representative Wisnot, is that there is history here. And you'll be hearing a lot of the history over the next 2 days. I have some that I'd like to share.
Ouch!